Science can't explain everything. Just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm not here.
Thank you for joining me, everyone, and welcome to Paranormal Encounters podcast series. My name is Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz. I am the host and the producer of this show. Sit back, grab yourself some popcorn, and let's get started.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yes, indeed. Let's get started here. Please welcome my guest this evening, Jason McLeod.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
When was the last time that you looked under your covers, looked under your bed, looked into a closet, looked into a very dark room, and wondered this question: is there a boogeyman in here? Now, that might seem a bit strange to most of you. Why would you take that moment to wonder and ponder this? Only if and then you might be feeling or sensing an outside guest that doesn't necessarily belong in your environment. Let's step into the world tonight with our guest, Jason McLeod, who is a paranormal investigator, demonologist, spiritualist, and intuitive empath. He is also one of only a small handful of investigators who began their instruction and career working for and with the late and legendary Ed and Lorraine Warren. McLeod, who has spent the last 33 years helping individual families deal with human spirits, some which linger in their lives and refuse to leave their lives, and the inhuman spirits who seek to ruin their lives. McLeod is the author of the Dark Seas series, beginning with his first self-published novel called Dark Seas, A Connecticut Family's Nightmare, the terrifying true case of demonic infestation, oppression, and possession, as well as Dark Seas 2, The Nightmare Returns. McLeod has conducted engaging and enlightening presentations on the subjects of spirituality, consciousness, quantum physics, metaphysics, paranormal investigation, and demonology, as heard on radio broadcasts such as Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie and at paranormal and horror conventions throughout the country. In the year 2024, he will be appearing in over 20 major conventions. Tonight, McLeod will explain his understanding of the science and spirituality behind the paranormal and how people can protect themselves and their living spaces from diabolical infestation. We had a lot to talk about this evening, so sit back and grab that blanket, because my guest this evening might just have you pull that up a few more inches. Please welcome to the show, Jason McLeod. Well, good evening, Jason, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, this is going to be a very interesting show tonight, because you are perhaps, I would say, one of two, almost going to be one of three actual, like, I don't know if you would call yourself a demonologist or a spiritualist, but somebody who is going to really delve into the unknown for us, the spooky unknown, and really kind of bring it home tonight. So everybody, you sit back and grab that popcorn and that blanket, because here we go. So Jason, you know, there's a lot of people that don't do what you do. And of course, you know, everyone wants to know, well, how on earth did they end up becoming X, Y, and Z? I think we're just going to go from the beginning as usual. And where did this interest of yours begin Can you go way back as far as you can and then help us evolve as we go throughout the session tonight?
Sure. Thanks. That's a great question. And I think it is very important for people to understand, you know, where do people get their beginnings from? And I can go all the way back to when I was a little boy. I was always fascinated in ghost stories. And I believed that we were, spiritual beings always and connected to everything, having a brief physical experience. And I was always in the middle school and high school library studying film strips with the cassette tapes. I'm dating myself, but that's the ancient technology that we had, where you're trying to, sync it up and listen and so forth. But when I was a senior in high school at Staples High School in Westport, Connecticut, I pulled off the book, The Demonologist, from the library shelf. And it was Ed and Lorraine Warren's most terrifying cases that could allegedly all be proven in a court of law because there were so many people in positions of authority witnessing the activity that they described in the books. And I was terrified for the families that were enduring these types of attacks, and especially the children. I said, no child should have to endure this type of horror, especially inside their own home. But I put the book back on the shelf, even though I lived in Connecticut, and I actually lived in Monroe, Connecticut, where the Warrens were living then, when I was a little boy, for part of my early childhood, I lived in Monroe. I just didn't feel the need to get involved, but the seed was planted. And 4 years later, the next year, I wanted to go to Emerson College for English Creative Writing or Roger Williams in Rhode Island, because they were fantastic writing schools. And my dad was paying for my college education. And he said, you're never going to make it as an author. You're going to go for a communications degree at Eastern Connecticut State U, which I did. And the entire freshman in class had to read Life After Life by Dr. Raymond Moody. Mm-hmm. And he was the most famous past life regression hypnotic therapist that there was. And I read his book and I was stunned. And then I stumbled onto Dr. Edith Fiore's book, The Unquiet Dead. And that's a story that was a field that was stumbled upon accidentally. And it ended up being something called human spirit cohabitation. And that really intrigued me. And then I didn't go back to Eastern Connecticut. I took a year and a half off. I was antiquing with my mother. I got into my first rock band. I was singing in my first band. And I, my dad thought I was going to turn into a hippie, and he was furious. And then I decided that I wanted to go back to school. So I applied for Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. And it was a Catholic university. And I was with my friend Lou in his car. Lou is a former Army combat medic with the rank of captain. And he was a high ranking paramedic in the Norwalk, Connecticut EMS field. And I was sitting in his car and we were listening to the radio, and it was about the Warrens. And I said, that'd be so cool to work with them. And he said, yeah, no kidding. The next day he called me and said, you aren't going to believe who just called me. Mm-hmm. And I asked, well, who? And he said, Ed Warren. And I'm mm-hmm. like, what? Come on. Mm-hmm. And the situation was that Ed was having heart issues at the time. Mm-hmm. And he called the chief of EMS to have a medic referred to him that he can invite to their Monday night class, because he really wanted to have a paramedic with he and Lorraine and the investigators on these really very hairy cases. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, they're inviting me to their Monday night class at their home. And I said, you have to get me in there. It's time. It was not time 4 years prior where the seed was planted, but I felt this is it, right? So he told Lorraine all about the synchronicity. And there's a big difference between a coincidence and a synchronicity. A coincidence is a random chain of events. A synchronicity is like the universe pulling everything together. And she said, okay, we'll invite Jason next Monday night. And I got to go. And I walked inside. There was this outbuilding on their property where they had the class. Mm-hmm. And Lorraine comes literally floating up to me in the distance, because she was taller than a lot of the investigators. Yeah. And she asked me a very pointed question. The very first thing she said is, hi, Jason, I'm Lorraine Warren, honey. Mm-hmm. Looking at me. Oh. How strong is your faith, honey? Right?
Yeah.
And I immediately replied, well, I have immense faith. I believe that I and the Father are one, mm-hmm. as are we all. And she nodded and smiled. And she asked, why do you want to get involved in work of this nature?
Mm.
right? And I explained I read The Demonologist. I was terrified for the families, especially the children, and I want to help. You know, and she asked, so it's a calling then?
Yeah.
And I said, I believe so. And she says, well, welcome aboard. And that was it. I felt like I walked into the wizard's tower at that point. You know, I got access to this incredible couple and their investigators. Now, the interesting thing is, I want to remind everybody, there was no internet back then, right. 1990. Right. There were no cell phones. There were no TV shows, because all the TV shows happened because of the Warrens, right, later on. Mm-hmm. Nobody was in it for self-aggrandizement or to make a name for themselves. Right. Everybody was genuinely interested in unlocking the secrets of the universe with this very enigmatic couple that's been at it for decades. Yeah. And these people were very serious and really, really interesting. And I wanted in, and I was in. And it was amazing to me, because then I met Ed, and he's dressed in a flannel shirt, you know, comes out, and he's showing everybody a room of about 15 investigators, showing everybody the evidence that many different people as investigators had gathered in the previous week on cases that they assigned them to, and pointing out how and why these things are taking place. And then they revealed there was a new case that came to their awareness in Devon, Connecticut. And the interesting thing is, they assigned Lou and I, this is Lou's second class, this is my first class, and they assigned he and I to this case alone, representing the Warrens. And I'm like, what? You know? Yeah. And I was like, cool, you know, I'll go for it. And it was amazing to me. But that's how it all began. And it was just, you know, it's all synchronicity. It is a calling. It was a calling. I wanted to help people. I wanted to unravel the secrets of the universe. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I'll tell you something funny, is one time my sister-in-law was over with my brother. And she asked what I was doing. It was Friday night. And I said, I'm going on a case investigating this paranormal activity going on inside one of these homes. She's like, that's not normal. You should be on a date, right? I'm like, the dates can wait. I want to unravel the secrets of the universe. And if I can find a date to go with me, that'd be cool too. But it was like, I was looking for the deep meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a question regarding one of your beginning cases. Now, let's step back just a second here, because I need to, for those of you that might be learning about this for the very first time, or you're familiar with it, but you need a refresher course, correct me if I'm wrong. Did the Warrens have demonic or negative activity occur in their own residence? Is this what sparked their interest in doing this or trying to go after this themselves? Or where did this interest lie with them? Because somehow you got grabbed into it, right? You're now pulled into it. But give us a flavor.
So
Ed and Lorraine Warren.
So Ed Warren, from what I know, from the stories that he's told, lived in a haunted house as a boy, and he was very interested in unraveling the secrets and finding out why this was taking place. At the same time, Lorraine was a clairvoyant. Mm. I heard stories that she was in a Catholic girls' school on Arbor Day, and they planted a tree, a sapling, and Lorraine, as a little girl, was looking up into the sky. And then one of the nuns, the sister, came up and asked, what are you looking at? She said, I'm looking at the tree. It's so beautiful. And she was seeing the fully grown tree as it looked when it was going to be fully grown. And of course, she got a whack on the knuckles for that, because that's a no-no. So, they met. And Ed is an artist, was an artist. And he would go, and when he would learn that there was some activity going on in some person's home, he would go and paint the home for them. This is all hearsay. I've never witnessed this.
Yeah.
And then go knock on the door and show them the painting that he painted. And then that would, he hoped to gain him access to the house to try to discern figure out what was going on with the case. Now, the interesting thing is, they were the ultimate dynamic duo, if you will, like mm-hmm. Batman and Robin, because he was the one that studied. Apparently, he was the only non-ordained demonologist, one of seven in the world that was recognized by the church that wasn't actually ordained, mm-hmm. because he had studied all these manuscripts and texts, and I'm not sure who he studied with or under, mm-hmm. but the man was just a fountain of information, and the amazing, amazing information that he had. And Lorraine is the sensitive. So he mm-hmm. would go and be able to determine what is happening or what type of entity they were dealing with based upon the activity that was happening or occurring in the home. And she would be sensitive enough sometimes to see or to intuit or discern what exactly was taking place, especially like earthbound human spirits, why they're lurking around, why they're here, whether there's a great feeling of tragedy or remorse or sadness or anger, right? And it was incredible to be among them. Yeah. On some of these cases. And the most profound was a case that I'm now writing a full-length novel about that happened in 1990. It's probably my fourth or fifth case that I went on with them. And that changed my life forever. But I'm not sure where you want to go with this, with the interview, but that was, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be called The Demon of Daybreak Farm. And oh, wow. There's a video out now. Devin Bellinger from Mysterious World TV flew out to Connecticut and filmed B-roll where my case took place that I call Dark Siege of Connecticut Family's Nightmare. But I also have the audio from that case in Vermont, the most intense aspect of that case. And we actually wove that into a documentary style video. It's available on Vimeo. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really intense. And it's amazing because people get to actually hear genuine audio footage of this case with Ed and Lorraine and the rest of us completely freaking out about what was taking place. It was so wild.
Let's talk a little bit, if you can, about some of these. I know people are, they love stories, and I know that we relate very well to stories. Do you have a case or two that you went on or went on with someone else that you can talk about, or at least leave out the names or leave out where they lived or something like that, and just give a generalization of it so people can kind of understand what kinds of things you actually go through? Do people call you? I guess I should start with that question. Do people call you and say, hey, there is something really nasty going on in my house. I don't know what it is. I can't explain it. This is what's happening. And then you decide, well, I suppose I better go. But I don't know. Oftentimes, I know, like in the case of another gentleman that will be on the show eventually, and one that I had on at least a year ago, when people call, it's not like you have the money to get on an airplane and go fly and help these people out all the time. Now, I know that this is what this one gentleman was doing. He says, you know, after a while, I just ran out of money. You know, I can't just jump on a plane. So he was trying to teach people how to help him, you know, in different locations. What do you do when people call you? And secondly, can you give us a couple examples of what you've had to kind of go up against?
Sure. So the very first case that I went on with my friend Lou happened in, it was a newlywed couple. Mm-hmm. They bought a used home, old home, and they had a newborn baby. Mm-hmm. Every night, like clockwork, they said they saw this full apparition of a woman walk through their bedroom wall, ignore them completely, walk down the hallway in front of the baby's crib, scare the baby out of its wits, pass through the wall and disappear every night. Yeah. Very cut and dry. Yeah. I brought my mom's camcorder. It was an old VHS camcorder, mm-hmm, with the big tapes, you know.
Yep. I still have mine.
Mm-hmm. And so we set it up on a tripod aiming at the wall where they said she would appear every evening. I drew the blinds, lit a candle. Lou and I and the husband and wife waited in the baby's bedroom, peering down the hall. And I was waiting to see my first apparition. I mean, this was going to be the culmination of everything that I'd hoped for, right? And studied and dreamed of. And instead, it was we all watched down the hallway and we heard a crack, right? And it was a bright blue flash of light, like lightning had gone off inside that room. We're all like, did you see that? You know, and then I said, okay, that's the doorway opening. It's the portal. It's the vortex, the wormhole, the tear in this fabric of space and time. And now this woman's going to come walking down the hallway. And nothing happened. Hmm. And we entered the room and we smelled a very overpowering, sickly, sweet almond smell. Okay. Didn't know what to make of that. And then we retreated back into the baby's room. Exactly 30 minutes later, another flash of light. The smell was half as intense. The light was half as intense. And we decided that after an hour and a half, nothing else happened. We were all very gravely disappointed, obviously. But we put the tape in the VHS machine in their living room because we wanted to see how bright that flash of light was, because I thought that's going to be amazing evidence. And we listened and watched the tape, and we hear my voice saying, we've just experienced the second flash of light. And there was absolutely nothing that was saved onto that VHS tape. And we're like, wow, what? You know? And then Lou picked up a heartbeat. He's a paramedic. And he picked up three distinct heartbeats, completely freaked him out of his mind. we would have missed it because we're not trained to listen to heartbeats. The interesting thing is the camcorder wasn't sensitive enough to pick up a heartbeat beating inside somebody's chest. There was nobody who was standing by the camera during that time. We didn't know what to make of that. So I brought the tape back to the Warrens the next morning. We went over it on the next Monday night class. Lorraine explained that she was there. She was basically broadcasting that light through our physical eyes, bypassing our physical eyes directly into our pineal glands, which are our third eyes. They have rods and cones. They're photosensitive. It's how we see a full color dream in a pitch black room when we're sleeping. It's how we daydream. And she beamed that right into our third eyes. It's also how, for instance, you'll sit in your chair in your home and you'll hear creaking floorboards above you and you know there's nobody above you. How is this possible, right? There's no physical weight being applied to these floorboards, but the spirit is projecting what that creaking sound would sound like directly into your mind, so it gets your attention. And the heartbeats were a message directly for Lou. And he was about 50% scared out of the entire idea of being a paranormal investigator because he couldn't cope with it. He can deal with physical horrors, but that blew him away. And I was completely hooked, of course, you know? And so that was, you know, it was very interesting and everything. But one of the next cases was I went on with four other of the Warren investigators who were, again, the more seasoned than I was. And we were in a house sitting on a sectional, and on the stairwell, on the landing, one of the psychics described this black form standing on the landing. And it was pitch black in the room, and it was a negative blackness, right? Because it's an extra low vibrational frequency. It doesn't belong there. It's something completely outside of space and time. And out of my pocket, I withdrew a pair of blessed rosary beads that my grandmother had given me for protection. And somebody said, "Jason, what did you do?" I'm like, "What?" Right? "He has rosary beads." And I said, "Put them away quick." Right? And I'm like, then I'm fumbling with them and trying to stick them back in my pocket. Unbeknownst to me, this form went right up to me when I pulled those out of my pocket. And when I put them back in my pocket, it went back up to the stairs. The next Monday night class, I asked Ed, "Well, what could have happened?" And he said, "It was your intention that meant everything. Your intention was self-preservation. You weren't challenging it." Mm-hmm. If I had challenged it, he said, if you challenged it, or your intention was to challenge it in any way, it could have burned you, could have teleported you, could have smothered you, could have choked you, could have done all of these, scratched you, beaten you, you know, all these things. And I was like, I've always felt protected, right? And I still to this day have not been physically attacked by any unseen force, although I know this happens because I've seen it happen to other people around me. Mm-hmm. And it's not because I'm any more special than anybody, but I just believe I'm protected, and I believe it, right? Yeah.
That's
the Father are one.
Let me jump in here for a second. Yeah. Interesting. Why is it interesting? Well, I don't know if you've ever been in Zach Bagan's Haunted Museum, but you are describing something that I came down to a final conclusion on once I got attacked in there. And I had a cross and I wore it openly outside here like this. And I kept rubbing it just to give myself reassurances that nothing in there was going to hurt me. Oh. Well, I was hunting ground. I shut the place down for 8 minutes. I got frequency attacked so badly and on the stairwell. I did get scratched. I was followed by a puppet. There's many things that happened to me in there just because of this. And after it was all said and done, I concluded that I was probably provoking whatever it was, thinking, "Oh, you think that's gonna save you? You think that that's gonna help you?" And my sister was with me. She wore hers inside, but nothing happened to her. But she saw the end result. What happened to me? That's right. Really interesting that you brought that up, because I would not have expected something. And I have seen very blacker than a dark area mass, even in my own house, but never challenged it. But the thing is very interesting that it would actually come up to you and then maybe attempted to take you on just because you're holding those rosary beads.
Yeah, I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel anything. I didn't sense anything wrong. I was spooked when they told me, "Put them away quick." I'm like, what's going on, you know? And it went back up to the stairs. But that was my first encounter with a demonic spirit. Right. Mm-hmm. That basically, you know, it didn't attack me because my intention never was to challenge it. It was always just self-preservation. I'm going to use this to, you know, and Ed always said he'll never challenge spirits in the name of Ed Warren. That would have invited an attack upon him of epic proportions. And these are very, very serious cases that they got involved in. And that's why he ended up having heart issues and he wanted a medic, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Correct me again. And I'm going from memory sake here. Annabelle, who belonged to Annabelle? Are you familiar with?
From what I know, from what I was told, is that a woman, there was a nurse, and her mother bought this doll from a secondhand store for her, and they brought it home. And this case is in the demonologist book, by the way. That's the first time I heard it. So that's when I talked about it when I wrote my book, way back when, before the movies came out. But they actually started using a Ouija board to communicate with this spirit nearby. And she claimed to be a little girl, and that she died tragically, and that she would love to live again and come live inside one of the two women. And they're like, I don't think so. That's not a bad idea. That's a bad idea. You go live inside the Raggedy Ann doll, right? And then all communication stopped. They were obsessed, by the way, with using the Ouija board. They wanted more and more information. And that's the most dangerous phase of Ouija board use, is you become obsessed with it. You can't be satisfied with what you get. You want more and more and more until whatever you're talking to demands something of you. Oh, well, I want to be go live inside you now. And they're like, no, but you can live inside the doll. They gave it permission. So it's all our God-given free will. Our God-given free will can invite the power and protection of the archangels and the angelic kingdom. Our God-given free will can open the doorway to ruin by interacting with diabolical entities. And so what happened is all this activity started taking place where the doll would be seen standing out upright when they got home in the middle of the hallway, allegedly. It would be on the bed. It'd be doing all these things. One of the girlfriend's boyfriend was over, and he said, "You're just a effing doll." And he had nightmares about he was being attacked by the doll. And when he woke up, he had scratches all over himself. And were they self-inflicted? Who knows, right? But you know, Ed Warren came to investigate, and they said this was not the spirit of a little girl you've been talking to, obviously. And he took the doll, and he had it put in the case and blessed, and so forth. And you know. For the record, I'm against the entire museum idea, and I think it is a hazardous thing. And to have all of these objects put on pedestals like there's something, some work of art that should be adored or revered, is nonsense. And I'm 6'6", and I bumped my head on a dragon sculpture in Ed Warren's museum hanging from fishing wire. And he had signs everywhere, of course, and warned us all the time, if you ever come in contact with anything, tell me. And I told him, and he said, "You just touched the worst thing possible." I said, "Then why is it here? Yeah. That I can interact and put myself in danger by touching it." But here's the thing that most people don't understand, including Zach, I would say. I will never go to his museum. Our electromagnetic field extends well beyond the reach of our extended arms. The little narrow spaces between these tables, where all these objects are set like they should be, you know, revered, we're sweeping right through all that stuff with our auric fields. And it's not like we're going to become possessed, but just like your car gets dirty, your car windshield gets dirty from the grimes and the bugs and the rain and the snow and the dirt, our auric field becomes infected or clouded, right? Becomes dirtier and dirtier. And since everything is frequency and vibration, if it is so dirty and so overcome by dark energy, it can lower your energy and put you at greater risk to making a connection with something that actually can penetrate your auric field and cause you problems. So I think, you know, it's dangerous and it's foolish, and these objects should be buried in salt and blessed and forgotten about. Not why would you pull something out of somebody's house that is a catalyst to the ruin of their family and then put it up on a bookshelf and look at it all the time and focus on it with your awareness? It's these things, we're not keeping these objects. The people that have these museums are not keeping the objects. Those objects are actually keeping them.
Right. Yeah. And just as a disclaimer, everybody, it's not like we're telling people not to go into Zach's museum. I'm going to tell you this right now that I can't, and I've brought this up on many of my shows, by the way, when I talk about what happened to me, I can't, because I'm so sensitive I really am, that I am hunting ground for anything out there that wants to mess with my, as we would say, aura or sensitivities. That's how sensitive I am. My sister was with me and she had absolutely no effect whatsoever. People believe that if you put this stuff behind glass or a plexiglass of some sort, that its energy will not come through and hurt you. What are your thoughts about that?
So nothing is physical as we understand physicality to be, right? And quantum physics has turned Newtonian physics on its ear and proven that nothing is really physical. Everything is frequency and vibration, right? And these objects are often infused with or connected to very, very low frequency vibration, something that's very, very dark and very negative. So how would putting something behind a glass case or a glass pane of glass or inside a wooden case, when that's really not even a physical construct, everything is waveform and particle, do anything, right? Now, blessing something is completely different, but putting something inside a box that's made of wood and glass, why would that prevent the frequencies from coming out and going in? It doesn't make any sense to me, and I don't buy it, right? But blessing something, so if you look at holy water, I like talking about this a great deal. So Dr. Masaru Emoto's work on his water experiments, where he would hold the water and feel an emotion, right? Or write the words, I love you, or thank you, or I want to kill you, or I hate you, and then freezing them, right? And then looking at the molecular structure of the crystals, they're always the same no matter what the emotion is, right? And what are we made of? Water, right? Mostly water. So when you have a priest or anybody blessing water or infusing it with the power of the ultimate power in the universe, which is God Almighty, the creator of all that is, and you cast that very high frequency water on a negative being that is not from this plane, that is something more diabolical and darker than you can imagine, it is like battery acid. And that's why they wail and they scream and they screech. It's easy to understand that everything is frequency and vibration. So the problem with these museums is, and these horror conventions and the paranormal conventions and stuff, and I'm doing like 30 this year so far. We're going to show where I'm going to be. I do them all year long every year, is that it attracts a lot of people who are depressed, who are very, you know, negatively affected, who are seeking some kind of thrill, right? And what are they drawn to? They're drawn to the things of the same frequency and vibration. So the very dark stuff, the dark masks, the dark costumes, the dark movies, the darkness in general. And when you have a frequency bridge that matches these entities, because you're already in a very low vibrational state, you can actually create a connection. So when people go into these types of museums, Lorraine always asks, the very first question Lorraine asked me was, how strong is your faith? If you have no faith, right, that you are protected and connected to the creator, it's like you're a Star Trek starship without the shields on.
Yeah. Okay?
And it's so vitally important. And she was always very adamant, saying, no drinking. Right. The night before an investigation, no drugs, recreational or otherwise. Get a good night's sleep. Make sure you're physically fit. Make sure you're in a strong emotional, mental state. Otherwise, you're not going to come with us under this case, because you're putting everybody else in danger you can be affected by these spirits that seek to do us harm. The cases they got involved in, like I'm saying, this isn't just, you know, a regular earthbound human spirit. In many cases, they would send their investigators on those, but they would get personally involved in the really serious stuff. But Lorraine's number one concern always was for the safety of her investigators. She would call a case off completely if things got too hairy, because she didn't want anybody to get hurt. It's not worth it, you know? And people need to really consider all these investigators all over the world. You know, you have to take your faith into consideration. You have to take all of those things into consideration before stepping into something that you might wish you didn't step into. And then it's up to the clergy, all right, who have to come to your rescue. Ultimately, it's the exorcists and the deliverance ministers, Bill Bean and Archbishop Enright and Bishop Long and Archbishop Cloud, are people that I work with, and I bring them in to the convention that are the amazing event called Defeating the Demonic that I did in July and I'm doing in October, to show the world this is the end result of dabbling in things you don't understand, and they have to clear up the mess, and they're sick and tired of it. You know, You know, in order, well, the most important message is the reason I'm out here doing what I'm doing is to warn people, don't open doorways that you shouldn't open, that you don't know what's going to come through or when it's going to come through. Mm-hmm. The secret is that the human perception, the human eyes can only perceive visible light.
Right.
Which is less than 1% of the matter, space, and energy around us. We're 99% completely oblivious to everything going on around us. And then we'll say, well, nothing happened if I used the Ouija board. Nothing happened in the range of frequencies that you can discern.
Right. Let's talk about that Ouija board. You know, recently my niece had asked me a question, which I thought I could answer pretty well, but before I get into the question, I want to tell you a situation, and then I'm going to go into the question. I'm going to have you take it from there. So this is interesting. So I was at a conference probably a couple of years back, and there was a vendor there that had many different Ouija boards dating back to the earliest one that was made to more of the more recent. And I'm sorry. I hope they never, I mean, if they hear this program, I'm sorry. I just have to chuckle a little bit. But we were standing there and someone was asking about these Ouija boards, whether or not they're active or not. And the one vendor was saying, I cleansed all these Ouija boards. There's not one Ouija board here that's going to hurt anybody. And when he said that, This is where it gets kind of spooky, but kind of funny. The vendor's booth next to him, one of his displays absolutely collapsed at that point that he said that and fell onto the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So then we're all looking. And of course, you know, the guy's picking up his little, you know, because it was just perfect timing there. Then he goes, I can guarantee you. And he goes right into it again. That there is not, I personally cleanse these and there is nothing that's going to happen to anyone if you decide you want to purchase one of these today. And I kid you not, as God as my witness, one of the Ouija boards, which was on, you know, how these shelves have kind of a lip so they, you know, there and it holds it in like this.
Yeah.
I kid you not, I was standing right there. It jumped up and jumped off from behind the lip, where there's no way that it could have been knocked off or anything, but it jumped off literally and completely fell onto the floor and kind of made a big commotion. And of course, people were kind of screaming a little bit. But I thought that it was just so funny how he kept saying, nothing's going to ever happen. And all of a sudden, all this stuff is happening. Now, my niece had asked me a question. She said, well, you know, then why do they sell these things as a toy? Why do they keep selling them? So I'm going to put Ouija board use and why into your hands, and maybe you can help answer that question for me.
So, great question. And I'm against Ouija boards. I get in confrontations with people at conventions and ask them if they're willing to accept the full commercial liability for any damage that takes place from the use of a Ouija board. And that the analogy can be similar to like gun shows, right? Well, you know, I manufacture the gun. I don't pull the trigger. Okay. So if you look, everybody go to Google and type in Parker Brothers logo. And the Parker Brothers logo, they were selling it commercially for decades, is a spiraling vortex. It's a black circular vortex. And they know exactly what they're doing. When you read the instructions inside the box, you know, it's sold as a game, but it's not. And I'll quote Ed Warren, my mentor and friend, and I studied under him as a demonologist. And he said, the Ouija board, is a direct quote, is the most dangerous piece of negative occult paraphernalia in existence. Responsible for over 95% of every case of diabolical infestation, oppression, and possession that Lorraine and I have investigated in the decades that they've been involved. And he said, it's a fool's paradise. It's not a cure-all for what ails you. And it's the antithesis or the opposite of what tarot cards are for divination. And it's almost, he said, like the devil said, well, I want my device too. Tarot cards, you know, you can use divination to get, you know, information in the pendulums and things like that. But I get my due as well. Who knows if that's the truth? I've heard enough horror stories from people who come up to my tables at my vendors show at my conventions and tell me the absolute nightmares that took place when they used the Ouija board, how they're unable to destroy them or dispose of them because they just move around. They reassemble themselves after they've been cut into pieces. And people will never, they'll scoff and they'll laugh if they don't experience it themselves, just like they'll scoff and they laugh at the notion of demons. But until you experience it yourself, just like until you have your own near-death experience, you won't understand what a near-death experience is like. You really won't grasp what's going on. But if there's one story out there where a family or an individual claims that this was the ruination of their life, mm-hmm. and they could not dispose of it, right? And it was just a curse to them and their family. That's reason enough to say, let's look at something else. You know, that you don't need a Ouija board. Now they're selling them as the Holy Spirit board. Talk to Jesus. The Barbie board.
Are they really?
Yeah. look in Google, you'll find it. We're like, you can't, unbelievable, right? So I get in arguments with these people and stuff because I said, you're creating something that somebody's going to use as a tool, completely oblivious to the fact of what they're doing. And then there's the argument, oh, well, they weren't declaring exactly what they wanted to communicate with, and they weren't closing any doorways. Well, who knows how to do that? And if we can only see 1% of the matter, space, and energy around us, and you say nothing's happened, how do you know nothing's happened? So Ed said it's like taking a Ouija board taking a bullhorn and saying, come mess with my life.
Yeah.
Because it's our God-given free will. If we're going to call these forces in with not knowing who we're addressing. So if you're on a Ouija board and you're saying, are there any spirits here? Right? As a preteen group of friends, right? Any spirits here? You know, well, where is that quantified or identified? Spirits where? In this room, in the house, on the property, in the town, county, state, country, continent, planet, universe, multiverse, dimension. I mean, there's nowhere that's properly identified. And they're always bad spellers. He says it's like an English teacher's nightmare, if you will. You always get, you know, ridiculous spelling and words and so forth. But you're invoking these beings to use your musculature and your bones to manipulate the planchette. When you think about it, right? Who else is moving? Everybody visualizes a pair of hands on the other side moving it across from you. But if you're moving it by yourself, because you're connecting with something, you don't know where it is, what its intentions are, what its power levels are, whether it's lying to you or not, what its end goals are, right? And then you become obsessed with it and use it over and over and over until you can finally not stop, which is the most dangerous phase of Ouija board use, which tells you there's a major problem there because it's basically convincing you, use me more, and slip up and say the wrong thing. And then all communication stops, like with the Annabelle story. She gave it permission. You're not going to live in me, but you can go live inside that doll. You know, and then there it is, and it's welcomed into your world. And who has to come rescue you? It's the clergy, mm-hmm. by and large. There are people who aren't, you know, ordained clergy members who were able to help with these situations. But why take a risk mm-hmm. like that? I think they're extremely dangerous. I would never use one. The fact that there are paranormal groups out there using Ouija boards inside people's homes when they're there claiming to want to help them is absolutely ludicrous. And I think everybody, if you want to dispose of your Ouija board, dig a hole in the ground, fill it with sea salt, put the board on the sea salt, cover it with sea salt, invoke the power of Archangel Michael or Jesus Christ to come and take this out of your life forever and sever any cords that are connected to you and ensure that nobody else who may ever dig it up by mistake is affected in any way. So we have the power to call upon the power of God, right? We have the authority to call upon the power of Archangel Michael, for instance, but lots of people don't pray correctly.
Right.
Oh, please come help. Please come help. Archangel Michael, please come help me. You know, I'm feeling overwhelmed, which is really saying, I don't know if you're hearing me, if I even have the authority to call or summon you, if you're even paying attention, if you're going to come at all, and if you do, in what capacity, and I don't really believe you're going to help me in the first place, so why am I even bothering? It's such a weak prayer. Mm-hmm. Anything you ask for in faith, you shall receive. Mm-hmm. So I say, thank you, Archangel Michael, for being here now, meaning it's already so before I even finish my sentence. Thank you for drawing your sword, for severing any connections with this Ouija board and myself, for closing any doorways that I've opened inadvertently or intentionally, for keeping this thing out of my life forever, ensuring that no harm comes to anybody who used it on this property or in this house, or anybody that interacts with it in the future. In the name and the power and the glory of God Almighty, in the name and the blood of Jesus Christ, so it is. And you believe it, right? They're there in a flash. You can't perceive them because we only can perceive visible light. Just like you can't see the demonic spirits or any of the interdimensional beings, which is another entire realm that nobody even thinks about. Mm-hmm. It's not just ghosts of humans and demons. It's everything else in between that also you can't perceive. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. It's dangerous business. And people, you know, I really wish people would focus on living, focus on life. We're all going to experience vacating the human body, and it's nothing to be afraid of. You know, live your life here now. You know, you'll get the answers later.
So I want to address this because there are people out there, myself, including people that I know, that have had the burning sensation when the holy water is being used. And I just want to ask you your impressions of that, or what somebody should do, or what that might mean, or if it means anything at all, when they're having that feeling when they're being holy watered. And I'm talking people about the sensation of feeling burned or burning or something that caused you to go, ow, and you can actually locate it. So take it from there.
So again, everything is frequency and vibration, right? And you have to be very careful about the movies that you expose yourself to, whether it's on Netflix or television or the movie theater, the music that you expose yourself to, the thoughts that you expose yourself to, right? And the stories and the newscasts and things like that. Yeah. Everything has the ability to affect us if our vibration is in that state. So what is the number one feeling everybody sees when they go see a horror movie? Fear.
Fear.
Right? Fear is the lowest frequency there is. Heart-centered compassion is the highest frequency there is, right? So there are people who would never expose themselves to the things like the movie The Pope's Exorcist would expose them to. I can relate to that because I didn't even want to watch the trailer for that.
I know.
And I went and saw it.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah,
and the thing that disturbed me the most, and I watched it, it made perfect sense, and I've read about Father Amarth, is that the seething hatred that this demon had for everybody. Right. Anybody who's just generally interested in the welfare of the boy, right? They just, you know, this incredible rage. It just disturbed me so much. And it was like Gollum when he was coming, the spirit was coming through Bilbo when Gandalf asked him for the ring, you know, it's mine, you know, and he turns into this vicious thing.
Right.
And that happens more than people can realize.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not possessed at that point, but we have these entities nearby. So if you're in a low frequency state, you're depressed, you're feeling like hell, you know, you feel like a weight on your head, your eyes are fatigued, people are affected, they're corded, they're negatively affected by these near spirits nearby. And they're so intertwined with us in many cases that I would think you can feel a burning sensation or even an aversion. So I'm going to go back to Dr. Edith Fiore's The Unquiet Dead, and I'll give you a personal story about how this can affect anybody, especially even me, in that a young man, he was 21 years old, he went to a bar for the first time by himself to have a drink, and he had in his mind this thought that, I'd like an old-timer's drink, something that my great-grandfather would have had in an old saloon or something like that, and the bartender's like, makes him a drink, he has two or three, he goes home, he made it home safely. The next morning, he woke up stiff and cranky. His eyesight was diminished. He had pains in his back. He wanted things for breakfast that his mother, he never liked before. And he had an aversion to everything that he normally liked. His personality was completely changed from one trip to the bar. And she eventually brought him to a hypnotherapist, this Dr. Edith Fiore, who put him under. But she was stunned to find that she actually also hypnotized the spirit of the old man that he picked up in the bar, who gave him the thought to get that drink because he wanted it, right? He wanted to have that experience. He actually cohabitated this guy. He somehow made his way into his auric fields where he couldn't differentiate his own thoughts from this old man. And she convinced the guy, look, you've had your life experience. Your life was ended. You need to cross over and go, you know, start again. You're ruining this person's life who has the right to have his own body.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating study. It was opened up by accident. So in this case in Vermont that I worked on with the Warrens, there was a female who had been rushed 150 years ago, was going into labor, being rushed to the house to the midwife to have her baby delivered, and the wagon flipped and the body of the mother and the baby were both killed.
Mm-hmm.
her last conscious thought was get to the house. And you go there instantly. There's no time or space when you're outside of the body. So we were there investigating. The family had fled the house because there were so many things going on. But we were investigating the property. And I was the last one of the group to head back toward the house. And I felt like she was standing behind me looking at me, right? And I hadn't had any major psychic experiences except that blue light that I got in my third eye. And that hairy situation with that demon on the stairs. And I turned around and I said, come back to the house with us, right? To her, oh, he can see me, right? Because she hasn't had a connection in so long. So I connected with her big time, right? And we went back to the house. And then as everything was going haywire, my jaw drops and tears just stream down my eyes. And I go, Lorraine, this sadness, and it's all in the audio in this video that I have for rental and purchase. Completely overcome by this unbelievable grief that this woman, Priscilla, felt because she had lost her child. She was about to go give birth, and all of a sudden, baby's gone. Can you imagine the grief as a mother? Mm-hmm. I mean, and the next day, I was writing about, so I wrote a newspaper column called Hauntings for the Sacred Heart University Spectrum newspaper. So there's some history people you haven't heard yet. Mm-hmm. But I chronicled our cases together. So I have those articles on my website, darksiege.com. But I was writing for my column for that paper on Sunday. And I'm writing about it, and I called Lorraine up, and I said, Lorraine, I that was really, really so fascinating. You know, when are we going back? Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't even unpacked yet. You know, we'll see you Monday night. Okay, bye. Type. Lorraine, a minute later, I really feel strongly we need to go back there, right? She said, Jason, we haven't gone over the evidence yet. We don't have permission to return. The family fled. We don't even know how to contact them and so forth. We'll go over this all on Monday night. You know, like, I'm sorry to bother you. I was the newest member of the New England Society for Psychic Research. Yeah. I said, have a good night. I'll see you tomorrow night. A minute later, Lorraine, Jason, are you writing about this case for your column? I said, yeah, you're drawing it right to you. And she's saying, call Lorraine. So I couldn't differentiate my thoughts from hers. Mm-hmm. That's an earthbound human spirit, right? So when you have something that's diabolical that exists outside of our plane of existence that is not bound by the laws that we are all bound by when we incarnate here, mm-hmm. That seeks to destroy you and ruin your life.
Yeah.
You know, that's reason enough to say, you know, I don't think I'm going to go on this investigation tonight. My gut, my heart's telling me this could be dangerous. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm going to play with the Ouija board. I don't think I should go see this really terrifying horror movie mm-hmm. and expose myself to this potentiality. Mm-hmm. So here's the thing watching movies. If you watch a movie, whether it's on Netflix or in the movie theater, mm-hmm. and you watch it, immersing yourself in it as if you are the victim being chased by Jason Voorhees through the campground mm-hmm. or Michael Myers' victim or the victim of the demonic attacks, mm-hmm. you're basically consenting to everything that is shown to you in the movie, and you're actually inviting it into your life and into manifest into your life. If you watch as the observer, which is what I do all the time, and as if I'm looking at it from above, saying, I do not consent to this, you know, you pray during it or whatever you want to, just declaring your protection, that's a completely different animal. But we do expose ourselves all the time. We go out in public, you're exposing yourself. Who knows what people are practicing and what kind of things they're into and things like that. And you're bumping into them as a random encounter or synchronicity that takes place. I pay attention to that all the time. And there's people that I see that I just steer clear of, you know, and it's not like I see anything going on with them, but you can tell by looking at people's eyes most often when there's one eye that's off,
mm-hmm.
you know, or something that's just not right. Mm-hmm. Steer clear and be very wary. We are in an epic spiritual battle this time in our life here in this earth. And I work with incredible people. Archbishop Ronald Fyle Enright, he's the chief exorcist for the Order of St. Michael the Archangel. He's done this for over 30 years. And there were days where he's doing 3 exorcisms a day.
Oh my God.
He has exorcists all over the world under his jurisdiction. Bill Bean is always helping people going on the run. Archbishop Clouds in North Dakota, he's also a mental health expert. Bishop James Long was the first Catholic bishop to go and publicly help the paranormal community when they ran into things that they didn't really want to run into, but they did. And he has to come and save their necks. And he says flat out, I put an amazing event together last July to warn people about this called Defeating the Demonic. And it was a 4.5-hour epic event in person and live streamed. And now I'm having the follow-up to that or repeating of it, making it twice as long. in October in 2024 in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Good.
But to warn people and show them, look, this isn't a game. You know, it's Ouija boards aren't a game. They're a tool with which you can communicate with these entities that want to seek to destroy your life and destroy your family. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can't differentiate your thoughts between a demonic spirit who's planting ideas in your head, you know, images in your head and visions and symbols and disrupting your sleep and causing havoc mm-hmm. all throughout, you know. They do not fight fair, and they're nasty and evil beings, and they want nothing more than just to destroy you, to turn you away from God, to destroy your faith, and to lead you to, you know, lure you into things that can damage you. What people need to understand from my perspective is that most of the most terrifying cases that take place will never become public knowledge. The case that I wrote about and published that I called Dark Siege of Connecticut Family's Nightmare, the family was never going to come forward with it. And we told them, don't give it any recognition, mm-hmm. right? Don't think about it. It's over with. It's done with. And this case involved, it was the most severe case, the most rapid case of demonic infestation, oppression, possession, requiring exorcism we've ever experienced. It was within a week, which is unheard of, right? Mm-hmm. And then they came right back after this family 33 days later in what Ed Warren called the most devastating case of demoniacal retribution we've ever seen. They went after everybody, including incubus and succubus attacks, which are sexual. And it was Bishop Long that convinced me to include that aspect in the second volume, Dark Siege 2, The Nightmare Returns, because I write in a cinematic style that makes you feel like you're right there experiencing everything. I recreated the case using my English creative writing degree in a cinematic horror format. So you feel like you're right. It reads like fiction, like you're reading Stephen King, and you feel like you're right there experiencing everything as this case begins all the way to the end. And then the chapter analysis is the final 100 pages where I explain it all. Everything we talked about tonight is in there. How I met the Warrens, my first several cases, my belief and understanding about Ouija boards and holy water, and how and why these things take place. So my website's called darksiege.com, www.darksiege.com. I have everything on my site from the videos that are being released, my audio book that I just released on Audible, narrated it in my own voice, mm-hmm. because I know how all these characters talked, spoke, and acted. So that's exciting. It's audible.com on Dark Siege, and I have phenomenal reviews. In fact, my first review is from Archbishop Ronald Enright. He was blown away by it. So what else? I'm doing conventions all over the country. My first one is March 15th in Las Vegas at Days of the Dead. I do all these horror and paranormal conventions, comic cons, like Fan Expo, which are I do the largest ones that I can get into. Lots of these conventions I'll be lecturing and presenting as well as having my vendor table, which is really a great setup. I do a really great display and sell my books and sign them and autograph them and so forth. Dark Siege, Connecticut Family's Nightmare, Dark Siege 2, The Nightmare Returns. My third book is called Our Journey Home, The Handbook for the Transition. And it's a large print, color illustrated guide meant for everybody, teaching them to lose the fear of letting go of their body when the body fails. There's nothing to fear about leaving the body and returning to our natural state, which is awareness without form, and how to cross over properly and how to just shed all of this stuff that we believe that is important in our lives now, because it's really not in the end, and to move on. And it helps people in hospice and their loved ones and caregivers and everybody, because people who would read my chapter analysis section in the Dark Siege book say, oh, the analysis helped my mom lose her fear of letting go. And she passed quickly after that. And she was happy about it, which is beautiful. You know, if I can help one person, it's a wonderful thing. That, again, this family in the Dark Siege case never wanted to come forward. I found out that there were paranormal groups using Ouija boards inside people's homes. And I contacted John Zaffis and I said, what the hell's going on? He's like, it's an epidemic, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I called the woman involved in this case and she said, my God, you know, if you can spare one family from the nightmare that we went through, especially a six-year-old girl like Kelly, who was the first one affected, who she's the one that attracted the spirit home from the cemetery as they passed by, in the very beginning portion of the case, then just make sure nothing comes after us a third time, please, you know, and they want nothing to do with it. They're well off. They have no interest in reading the books. They don't want anything. Paranormal witness wanted to have the family on, and they said there's not a chance in hell you know, we're not even going to think about it. And I want to talk about this. I'm going to go, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing conventions all over the country. In May, I'll be at ParapsyCon in Ohio. The cool thing is that I've done so many podcasts like this with you, and this has been a really great one. And I thank you so much for having me on. But I've never done my own podcast, right? So I've just signed up. My friend Grace Cesaro helped me sign up for my TikTok account, which is @ Jason McLeod Dark Siege. So please follow me on that, because when I reach 1,000 followers, I can start broadcasting from the conventions that I'm at. So people who aren't able to attend these epic events, you know, are actually able to participate in it. I take a lot of participate in them with me. I take a lot of really fun videos, as you'll see on my TikTok, if you check it out, at the conventions, just to help, you know, convey information and have some fun, because you have to have fun too. Mm-hmm. And in between the conventions on the weekends, I'm going to really start booking my own private lecture presentation, Q&A, showing my documentary video, mm-hmm. and other things. So I have things to do.
On that note, thank you so much, Jason, for being on the show today.
Thank you.